Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings, chapter 12. We will call this chapter, Joash of Judah Repairs the Temple. Our context is this. In our last chapter, we saw the little boy, Joash, who was being hidden from the wicked queen, Athaliah, who was ruling in Jerusalem from 841 to 835 BC. During her reign, Joash, the rightful heir, in fact, the only heir in the house of David who was still alive, he was raised from the time he was 1 year old to 7 years old, being protected in the temple by Jehosheba, King Joram's daughter, and King Ahaziah's half-sister, Ahaziah having been killed in 841. And so now the little boy has grown up, and he's exercising his duties of kingship, and that's where we are now in 2 Kings 12, 1 through 3, as we contemplate the reign of Joash of Judah. Verse 1, in the 7th year of Jehu, and Jehu reigned in the north from 841 to 814, in the 7th year of Jehu, Joash, who ruled from 835 to 796, became king and reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah, who was from Beersheba. Throughout the time Jehoiada the priest instructed him, Joash did what was right in the Lord's sight. And of course, what was right means he got rid of idols and supported Yahweh worship. Verse 3, yet the high places were not taken away. The people continued sacrificing and burning incense on the high places. And I'm assuming that's burning incense to Yahweh on the high places, not to Baal or something like that. Joash's reign was 40 years. That was the same number as David and Solomon. Of course, he started at 7, so that means he died at 47, which is relatively young. And his death was not a pretty death, as we'll see at the end of this chapter. His mother is Zibiah from Beersheba down in the south in the Negev Desert. Zibiah in the Babylonian dialect is Tabitha, and in Greek is Dorcas, names that we remember because Peter healed. Tabitha, also known as Dorcas, in the book of Acts, kind of interesting. Now, as long as Jehoiada the high priest, this same high priest who protected him and arranged the conspiracy that killed wicked Queen Athaliah in 835, this same Jehoiada kept Joash on the straight and narrow as long as he lived. But as soon as he died, we see three very bad things being done by Joash. One, he seduces the princes of Israel, the leaders of Israel, to idolatry. Two, he lives scandalously by murdering a priest. In fact, the son of the priest, Jehoiada, who put Joash in power and protected his life through the first 7 years of his life, or 6 years of his life. And number three, Joash died ignominiously, having been assassinated. So Jehoiada was a good influence, but his influence didn't last past the grave. Let's see how Joash seduced the princes of Israel to idolatry after Jehoiada died. 2 Chronicles 24:7. For the sons of the wicked Athaliah had broken into the house of God and even used the holy things of the house of the Lord for the Baals. Well, that shows that there was a temple for Baal after Jehoiada died. That's bad business. 2 Chronicles 24:17-18. But after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. And they abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and the idols. So wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for their guilt. So right back to Baal and Astarte, the same gods that were up in northern Israel, which came originally from the Tyre and Sidon area. Joash managed to get them all back into the southern kingdom. And he's listed as a good king in all the list. And the reason is because it says, verse 2, Joash did what was right in the Lord's sight. But that was only when Jehoiada the priest was alive, the high priest was alive. When he died, he was bad as all the rest of them. And of course, when it says Joash did what was right in the Lord's sight, that means he did what was right outwardly, not inwardly. We have to remember this right and this good and bad of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah is a formal goodness and a formal evil. Did they put up idols? They're bad. If they tore down idols, they were good. Now, what were these high places that Joash did not take away? As John Gill says, they were used before the temple was built or set up in Rehoboam's time. contrary to the law of God, which required that sacrifices should only be offered in the place the Lord chose to dwell in, i.e. Jerusalem. So they were illegal, but the kings couldn't get rid of them. For example, here in 1 Kings 14:23, we read this, "For they also built for themselves high places and sacred pillars and asherim on every high hill and beneath every luxuriant tree." Now, these high places might not have had idols to Baal or Astarte in them. They could have been high places in which people burnt incense to Yahweh, which would be better, but still is illegal. Not even the best of Judah's kings could get rid of them until Hezekiah came along. Let's look at Asa, who ruled from 911 to 870. He fails. 1 Kings 15:14, the high places were not taken away, but Asa's heart was completely devoted to the Lord his entire life. How about Jehoshaphat, Asa's successor, 870 to 848? 1 Kings 22:43. He walked in all the ways of his father Asa. He did not turn away from them, but did what was right in the Lord's sight. However, the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Now, Jehoshaphat did manage in the third year of his reign to tear down those high places. We read that in 2 Chronicles 17:6. His mind rejoiced in the Lord's ways, and he again removed the high places and Asherah poles from Judah. That was in his third year. But by the end of his reign, the high places were back. 2 Chronicles 20, verses 31 through 33. Jehoshaphat became king over Judah. He was 35 years old, blah, 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 blah. He walked in the way of Asa, his father. He did not turn away from it, but did what was right in the Lord's sight. However, the high places were not taken away. The people had not yet set their hearts on the God of their ancestors. So Jehoshaphat, despite a valiant effort, has failed. And of course, our King Joash, where we are now, between 835 and 796, he's failed too. But now Hezekiah came along. He finally got rid of the high places. Hezekiah reigned from 716 to 687, so that's a good long time from now, almost 100 years later. Hezekiah got rid of the high places. We read that in 2 Kings 18, verse 4. He, referring to Hezekiah, removed the high places, shattered the sacred pillars, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake that Moses made, for the Israelites burned incense to it up to that time. He called it Nehushtan. How many of the Israelites were so idolatrous they even took the bronze snake that God told them to make as a type of Christ bearing our sins? Bronze snakes bore the sicknesses of the Israelites, and they made an idol out of that. But Hezekiah smashed them all. Here's what Adam Clark says about the high places and the idols. Quote, "Without the total destruction of these, there could be no radical reform. The toleration of any species of idolatry in the land, whatever else was done in behalf of true religion, left and in effect fostered a seed which, springing up, regenerated in time the whole infernal system. Jehoiada did not use his influence as he might have done, for as he had the king's heart and hand with him, he might have done what he pleased." But Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is not quite as hard on Jehoiada. Here's what they say. "In the early reign of a young king, and after the gross irregularities that had been allowed during the maladministration of Athaliah, the difficulty of putting an end to the superstitions associated with the high places was greatly increased." In other words, it was a hard job getting rid of the idolatry because of the people's hearts, so give Jehoiada a break. Well, I wasn't there, so I don't know what his situation was, Jehoiada's situation. So I'm not going to say either way, but we do know that there's still idolatry in the land in the time of Joash. I think we can take an application here. You don't get rid of idolatry, it'll spread. Sooner or later, it'll take root. You got some heretic in your church, you better take care of it. We go now to 2 Kings chapter 12, verses 4 through 5. Joash said to the priest, "Collect all the money that is brought as sacred offerings to the temple of the Lord, the money collected in the census, the money received from personal vows, and the money brought voluntarily to the temple. Let every priest receive the money from one of the treasurers, and let it be used to repair whatever damage is found in the temple." Now Joash, and remember, he's between 835 and 796, right after Athaliah. What were his options as to his motives? What are the options with regard to what his motives were in repairing the temple? Well, the most obvious motive was he had a pious devotion to fixing the Lord's sanctuary. Some people have suggested he wanted to fix up the place where he had lived as a child. So for nostalgic reasons, he reformed a repair to the temple. I don't think so. He seemed to have Yahweh in mind, and he wanted to build, repair Yahweh's temple. So in verse 4, he starts seeing how he can get the money to repair the temple. So all the money that was brought in, he mentions the census money. There were three sources of income Joash was looking to. The census money, the money that came in from personal vows, and money that came in from freewill offerings. The census money was the half shekel head tax. Everyone that was numbered in the census and was over 20 had to pay a half shekel head tax. This is Exodus 30, verses 13 through 14. This is what everyone who is numbered, i.e., listed in the census, everyone who is numbered shall give half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary. Half a shekel is a contribution to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered from 20 years old and over shall give the contribution to the Lord. So that was his first source of money. And then in verse 4 is mentioned money received from personal vows. That would be a personal vow offering, which was a kind of a peace offering. You made a personal vow to God, if you let me win this battle, I will sacrifice X number of oxen and goats, and I will give you X number of money and put it in the temple. It's a personal vow. And then a freewill offering is just somebody who comes to the temple and wants to give money to the temple voluntarily. So all three of these sources of income are coming in. And so in verse 5, Joash says, let the priest take this money and use it to repair the damages of the temple. Whatever damage you see, fix it. Well, now, the first question we ask is, with all that money that I just mentioned coming into the temple, why wasn't the temple repaired? Well, apparently the priests and Levites had converted the income to their own use. Either that or they were just storing it up. I don't know. Another question about this repair job. The temple was only 155 years old, says John Gill, so why did it need repair? Well, first of all, if I had a house that was 155 years old, it's going to need repair. Only 155 years old, Gill says. The houses in his time in the 19th century, or actually, I think he was the late 18th century, they must have lasted a long time back then if he thinks 155 years old is not very old for a building. But even besides natural deterioration of the building, we know from 2 Chronicles 24:7 that the temple had been broken up and misused by Athaliah and her sons. Let me read that verse, 2 Chronicles 24:7. For the sons of the wicked Athaliah had broken into the house of God and even used the holy things of the house of the Lord for the Baals. So the temple had been broken into, and we can assume it was damaged when that happened. We go now to 2 Kings 12, verses 6 through 8. But by the 23rd year of the reign of King Joash, the priest had not repaired the damage to the temple. So King Joash called Jehoiada the priest and the other priests and said, why haven't you repaired the temple's damages? Since you haven't, don't take any money from your assessors. Instead, hand it over for the repair of the temple. So the priest agreed they would not take money from the people and they would not repair the temple's damage. So 23 years into King Joash's reign, the temple is still not being repaired. Verse 6 tells us. Now, I don't know when Joash noticed this and when he was only 7 years old when he took over. I don't know when Joash started complaining to the priest about the temple not being repaired, but let's say, well, at least 10 years. How about that? Or 12 years, maybe. Long time. Joash finally says, no, we need to fix the temple. Well, why had the temple not been repaired for the first 23 years of King Joash's reign? Well, it could be people weren't paying the money. The contributions had dropped off. Or it could be the priests were converting the money to their own use. I don't know what it was, but Joash is pretty lenient with them. He just says, I tell you what, you're not doing the job. I'll take over and I'll do it. That's pretty lenient. I guess Joash didn't want to cause a stink. Here's what Adam Clark says about Jehoiada the priest who was called to King Joash. He's the high priest. Quote, it seems that the people had brought money in abundance, and the pious Jehoiada was over the priest, and yet nothing was done. Though Jehoiada was a good man, he does not appear to have had much of the spirit of an active zeal and simple piety. Without zeal and activity is of little use when a reformation in religion and manners is necessary to be brought about. Well, that's what we can say about Jehoiada. He was slack. I don't see how you can disagree with Clark there. 23 years goes by. Jehoiada is the high priest in charge of the temple. He's basically the regent of the kingdom, he could tell Joash exactly what to do and when to do it, and Joash would do it, but he still didn't bother to repair the temple. So Joash, in verse 7, tells his assessors, don't take money. Well, actually, he tells the priest, don't take money from the priest's assessors. Now, it appears from this that Joash is suspecting that the priests were using the money for their own purposes. Well, if he did think that, his response seems to be very mild. I think he was more interested in getting the job done than he was in assessing blame. He tells the priests, don't take money from their assessors. Now, this is an interesting word, assessors. I assume that means that whoever's collecting the money and accounting for it. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translations. I've got five other translations for this word. Don't take the money from your acquaintance, says the American Standard Version. Joash tells the priest, don't take the money from your neighbors, according to the Bible in Basic English. Don't take money from your acquaintances, plural, according to Darby, NASB, and the Young's Literal Translation. Don't take money from your donors, according to the God's Word Translation. The New American Bible says, don't take money from your clients. Well, apparently nobody has the foggiest notion of what that word means, the Hebrew word. So we'll just say it means whoever's responsible for giving you the money, don't take it from them anymore. So in verse 8, the priests agree that we won't collect money for those purposes that I just mentioned, the voluntary offerings, the vow offerings, and the census money, the head tax. We won't take that money. And in return for that, we're not going to repair the temple's damage. We won't be responsible for that anymore. They were probably glad to give up their responsibility because it could be that they were suspected of not behaving properly and it might not have looked good if there had been an audit. So they said, okay, Joash, you take care of fixing the temple. So we go now to 2 Kings 12, verses 9 through 12. But Jehoiada the priest took a chest and bored a hole in its lid and put it beside the altar on the right side as one comes into the house of the Lord. And the priest who guarded the threshold put in it all the money which was brought into the house of the Lord. And when they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's scribe and the high priest came up and tied it in bags and counted the money which was found in the house of the Lord. And they gave the money which was weighed out into the hands of those who did the work, who had the oversight of the house of the Lord. And they paid it out to the carpenters and the builders who worked on the house of the Lord, and to the masons and the stonecutters, and for buying timber and hewn stone to repair the damages to the house of the Lord, and for all that was laid out for the house to repair it. Now this chest that Jehoiada took, he bored a hole in its lid. That was so people could put the money through the hole. The purpose of the chest was to segregate the funds that would go for any other funds that would come into the temple. I'm not sure what they would be, but they would be given to the priest through the normal collection process. But now money given for the repair of the temple would be segregated out with his chest. And, of course, everybody would be told this is for building the temple. Now, this is a nod to human nature. People always give more to a dedicated fund than to a general fund. Anybody that deals with collecting money for Christian organizations knows that that's the way it is, or for charitable contributions. People hate to give to the administrative overhead, which is necessary. You know, the secretaries and the accountants and all, you have to pay for that, but people don't like to give to it. Now, what was the hole in the lid for? That's so they could lock the chest to prevent fraud. The money could only go into the chest through the hole, and nobody could pull money out of the chest. If the top was just open, somebody could put money in and then pull money out, and nobody could see them. So there's not only no fraud, there's no suspicion of any fraud. The chest was put on the right side of the altar in the courtyard, the court of the priest where the bronze altar was. But now we see later in 2 Chronicles 24:8. That the chest, having at first been set by the altar, was afterwards, for the convenience of the people, set without the gate or at the gate. That would be the gate of the outer courtyard, the gate of the people, the gate of the Gentiles. We read in 2 Chronicles 24:8, so the king commanded, and they made a chest and set it outside by the gate of the house of the Lord. Now that's not the gate of the temple. According to Benson, that's the gate of the courtyard. Ellicott says it was in the court just inside the gate. Poole says it was the court of the people, the court of the Gentiles, where all manner of persons might come to offer. In other words, it was easier to collect money from there because anybody could give money to it, even if they weren't Jews, maybe proselytes, even a Gentile. Anybody could come by there and put money into the box. Now, notice that they were priests who guarded the threshold. I assume that's priests who guarded the outer gate of the courtyard. They were in charge of this box, so priests are still collecting the money for the repair, but we just said that the priest had given up the right to collect the money in return for relinquishing the duty of repair. So these are obviously different priests to take the place of the other priests who were dismissed from their duties of repair. Now, I said these priests guarded the threshold. Well, the text says they guarded the threshold. It doesn't say the threshold of what? The temple or the outer court? John Gill says it's the outer court, the court of the Gentiles, which is entered through the beautiful gate. You go through that little narrow colonnaded court of the Gentiles, then you hit another gate, the Nicanor gate, and go up into the court of the women where all Jews could go, and then you go up some steps and you hit a balustrade there, and that's the court of men. Jewish women can't go there, but Jewish men came, and then you go through that balustrade and into the court where the bronze altar is, and that's the court of priests, where only the priest could go and the Levites could go. And then, of course, you go even further and go to the Holy of Holies. Only the priests could go there. The Levites couldn't. Now, verse 10 says that when these priests saw that there was much money in the chest, one might ask, how did they see since the lid was locked? Well, they could guess from watching the number of people who put offerings in, or maybe they could even look through the hole and see if the money had risen to the top. But however they discerned it, they would then take the money out of the chest, and then the king's scribe and the high priest, that's Jehoiada, would come and tie the money up in bags and count the money. So we've got royal authority, the king's scribe, and we've got priestly authority, the high priest Jehoiada. They're working together now to do the repairs. And of course, this is another good principle of finance, you had more than one person counting the money so that neither would be suspected of fraud. And that's why churches have always, they typically have two people counting the money. The problem is when you have a very small church, that's a problem. But it is a principle that cannot be gainsaid. You need to have two people counting the money. All right, so the work has been taken over in verse 11. The money was weighed out into the hands of those who did the work, who had the oversight of the house of the Lord. That would be laymen now, not by priests, as John Gill says. The work is now in charge of the king, not of the priest. And so these laymen who had oversight of the construction work here, they would pay the money out to the carpenters, the builders, the masons, and the stone cutters. So we go now to 2 Kings chapter 12, verses 13 through 16. But there was not made for the house of the Lord silver cups, snuffers, bowls, trumpets, any vessels of gold or vessels of silver from the money which was brought into the house of the Lord. For they gave that to those who did the work, and with it they repaired the house of the Lord. Moreover, they did not require an accounting from the men whose hand they gave the money to pay to those who did the work. That's the overseers. For they dealt faithfully. The money from the guilt offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought into the house of the Lord. It was for the priest. Now, verse 13 says, they didn't make cups and snuffers. Those are the little instruments that snuff out the candles, the seven-branch candlestick in the holy place. The bowls, of course, is for collecting blood of sacrificed animals. Trumpets would be blowing trumpets for special occasions, feast of trumpets, for example, a new moon. And then any vessels of gold or silver, whatever they might be, they didn't use the money that was collected for repairing the temple for all of the accoutrements, all of the implements of the temple. But now we have a reconciliation problem, because in 2 Chronicles 24:14 we read this, and when they had finished, they brought the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada, and it was made into utensils for the house of the Lord, utensils for the service and the burnt offering, and pans and utensils of gold and silver. They had to have pans to hold the cut-up meat. Well, that would be gold or silver pans. Utensils, they had to have forks to stick in the meat. Well, that would be gold or silver. And they offered burnt offerings in the house of the Lord continually all the days of Jehoiada. Well, that's nice, but it sounds like it directly contradicts 2 Kings chapter 12, verse 13, which says that all of these instruments were not made. Well, the solution is they didn't make the vessels at first. Because 2 Chronicles 24:14 says, and when they had finished, then they made the utensils. But while the work was going on, they focused the money on the repairs, the physical repairs of the temple. Now these overseers of the workmen were so honest that the high priest and the scribe, the officer of the king, the royal authority and the priestly authority, Jehoiada, they never called them to account. They didn't make them account for their money. Well, I want to tell you something. That takes a lot of faith. And in fact, I wonder about that, because to protect the overseers from any charge of peculation or dishonesty, it's nice to have an accounting so that they're covered for their good as well as for the good of Jehoiada and Joash. But at any rate, these people were pretty trustworthy. Verse 16, the money from the guilt offerings, those are trespass offerings, those are usually restoration, if you have to make restitution for some sin you did. The money from the sin offerings, that was to take away the sin of the people. We talked about it in the book of Leviticus. I'm not going to go into detail there, but the money that came in was for the priest. Well, first of all, why would money be coming in for guilt offerings and sin offerings? Well, because people would send money in from a distance instead of sending cattle, which is a lot of trouble. And then their agents in Jerusalem would buy the sacrificial animals. And their agents might even be the priest or the Levites. So the money that came in to buy these sacrificial animals, after the animals were brought, if there was a surplus, the priest would have it. And of course, some of those sacrificial animals, for example, with peace offerings, belong to the priest, although priest offerings are not mentioned here. I suspect they would include peace offerings. They were just not mentioned. I don't think that means anything. But at any rate, the priest got the extra money, and that's how they got supported, I suppose, while all the rest of the money was going into the repair of the temple. So the priest was still supported. We go now to 2 Kings chapter 12, verses 17 through 18. At that time, Hazael, king of Aram, marched up and fought against Gath and captured it. Then he planned to attack Jerusalem. So King Joash of Judah took all the consecrated items that his ancestors, Judah's kings Jehoshaphat, he ruled from 870 to 848, Jehoram, 848 to 841, and Ahaziah, 841, all of the consecrated items that those three kings had consecrated, along with his own, Joash's own consecrated items, and all the gold found in the treasuries of the Lord's temple and the king's palace, the temple and the palace, Solomon had built those, remember? They were glorious, gold everywhere. He strips the gold, and he sent them to Hazael, king of Aram. He bought him off, and Hazael withdrew from Jerusalem. So Hazael had gone to Gath. If you look at the map here, if you look at Jerusalem and go about 20 miles basically west, a little bit south and west of Jerusalem, you know Gath. It's in the Valley of Elah, which is the valley south of the Valley of Sorek. The Valley of Sorek is where Samson spent his time chasing women. And the Valley of Sorek is near where Ekron, one of the Philistine cities, was. Well, if you're at Ekron and go down the road that runs from Ekron to Gath about 6, 7, 8 miles or so, you hit Gath. It's one of the five famous Philistine cities. Well, that's pretty close to Jerusalem, about 25 miles. And so that's how far Hazael had gotten. And Hazael is a Syrian, so he's on the northeastern side of Jerusalem. And here, he's at Gath, which is on the southwestern side. So Hazael's invaded pretty good. Now notice in verse 18 that Joash, in his degradation, had given away his own personal items, the things that he had consecrated or dedicated to the temple. He gave those to Hazael. Hazael, by the way, ruled from 841 to 801, and so he's roughly contemporaneous with Joash. Well, buying off Hazael, that was not exactly a courageous response on the part of Joash. It was a bribe, basically. He got Hazael to flee. It showed no trust in God whatsoever, and the bribery didn't work because the next year Hazael returned. And Joash, having no more treasure, was obliged to hazard a battle, which he lost. The principal part of his nobility was killed. Jotah was totally ruined. And shortly thereafter, Joash was slain in his bed by his own servants. Let's read the parallel account, 2 Chronicles 24, verses 23 through 24. At the turn of the year, an Aramean army went to war against Joash. They entered Judah and Jerusalem and destroyed all the leaders of the people among them and sent all the plunder to the king of Damascus. Although the Aramean army came with only a few men, the Lord handed over a vast army to them because the people of Judah had abandoned Yahweh, the God of their ancestors. So they executed judgment on Joash, the they being the soldiers of Syria. Pretty sad. We go down to verses 19 through 21, and we'll finish up this audio. The rest of the events of Joash's reign, which was from 835 to 796, along with all his accomplishments, are written in the historical record of Judah's kings. Joash's servants conspired against him and killed him at Beth Millo on the road that goes down to Silla. His servants Jozabad, son of Shimeath, and Jehozabad, son of Shomer, struck him down, and he died. Then they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and his son Amaziah became king in his place, and Amaziah ruled from 796 to 767. Well, the rest of the events of Joash's reign are written in the historical record of Judah's kings, which we don't have now. That's lost. But we do have Chronicles, 2 Chronicles. So let's look at a couple of details that we can get from 2 Chronicles that have not been listed in 2 Kings and that I haven't talked about. We see in 2 Chronicles 24:3 that Jehoiada the high priest had given Joash two wives. 2 Chronicles 24:3 says Jehoiada acquired two wives for Joash, and Joash was the father of sons and daughters. We see in verse 15 of 2 Chronicles 24 that Joash was 130 years old at his death. Jehoiada died when he was old and full of days. He was 130 years old at his death. Now, most of the other accounts in 2 Chronicles 24, most of these events that are accounted for in that chapter, I've already mentioned here as we go through 2 Kings. Now, I mentioned in 2 Kings 12:21 that Jozabad and Jehozabad killed Joash. Let's read the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles 24:25 through 26. When the Arameans saw that Joash had many wounds, they left him. They left him to die. His servants conspired against him and killed him on his own bed because he had shed the blood of the sons of Jehoiada the priest, and also probably because he lost the war. So Joash died, and they buried him in the city of David, but they did not bury him in the tombs of the kings. By not burying him in the tombs of the kings, that's the ultimate way of showing disrespect to a king. Verse 26, those who conspired against him were Zabad, that's analogous to Jozabad. Jozabad in Kings, Zabad in Chronicles, close enough. Son of the Ammonite woman Shimeath in Kings, is the son of Shimeath. Ammonite woman is added in Chronicles. And Jehozabad, same name in Kings, son of the Moabite woman Shimrith. Interesting that we got pagans here working for the king, and they killed him. We also see from Chronicles that they didn't kill him while he was in a healthy, good place, Joash. They killed Joash when he had been wounded badly by the Arameans. The Arameans didn't even bother to take him. Seems like they would have taken him for a ransom, but they just left him to die. A very pitiful end to Joash's reign. I mentioned earlier why this conspiracy of the two J's, Jozabad and Jehozabad, why did it come about? Well, remember Jehoash had killed Jehoiada's son Zechariah. I mentioned that earlier. Zechariah had reproved Joash for his idolatry. That was the first reason the conspiracy got started. And the second reason, of course, is because Syria had devastated Israel in war. As Adam Clark says, concerning Joash's demise, never was the hand of God's justice more signally stretched out against an apostate king and faithless people than at this time. Now, Joash was assassinated at Millo, and nobody knows exactly what Millo is. Here's what Clark says. It was a royal palace built by David, situated between the old city of Jerusalem and the city of David. A royal palace? I don't think so. I like Easton's definition better. Probably the Canaanite name of some fortification consisting of walls filled in with earth and stone, which protected Jerusalem on the north as its outermost defense. So if you look at the city of David, Mount Zion, that little tongue of land that stretches out from Mount Moriah, Beth Millo, the house of Millo, or Millo, it is a barrier or a fortification between the northern end of the city of David and the southeastern corner of Mount Moriah where the temple was built. It is always rendered Akra, i.e. the citadel, in the Septuagint. It was already existing when David conquered Jerusalem. He extended it to the right and the left, thus completing the defense of the city. It was rebuilt by Solomon and repaired by Hezekiah. I believe it was a fortification to protect the northern end of the city of David. Adam Clark says that the Silla that is mentioned here is the road or causeway leading up to that fortification. And so we end the sad reign of Joash with a comment from Adam Clark, quote, "Thus ended a reign full of promise and hope in the beginning, but profligate, cruel, and ruinous in the end." And on that sad note, we are finished with 2 Kings chapter 12. We are now ready in our next audio to go to 2 Kings chapter 13, verses 1 through 25, the entire chapter, and we will see some mention of the next two kings of Judah, Jehoahaz and Jehoash, not Joash now, but Jehoash, and we're also going to see our old friend Elisha dying. So I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.